This weekend starts right after this.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, Geico makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to geico.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. Geico.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Where are the students? I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Untold numbers of children have disappeared from schools during the pandemic. We'll explain how districts are trying to find them.
On the personal finance front, debating whether or not to take Social Security early.
Museums are beginning to collect coronavirus artifacts. Here are the odd stuff that some people have donated.
And where have all of our work friends gone?
You know, I was thinking about it. For so long, obviously, like everybody else, it's been almost a year, and I got an email from one of my colleagues, and he wrote, it really stabbed me in the heart. He said, you're starting to feel like an old friend from the city I used to live in.
Beth Tytel at the Boston Globe on reestablishing ties with your work friends. Well, school districts across the country that closed buildings in mid-March last year in response to the coronavirus pandemic handled the transition to remote learning with varying levels of success. But during the disruption, schools lost track of students. Many students who were present in the classroom in early March could not be found online, and others who showed up in the spring haven't been seen since. It's a story by Mariah Balingit at the Washington Post. Mariah, where's this happening?
So this is happening in a lot of big cities. We've seen enrollment drop across the nation in public schools. A lot of that is kids in pre-K and kindergarten who never showed up to enroll. So these were not kids that were necessarily in the school system before. But I spoke to Detroit, to places in Texas. It's really happening in a lot of large school districts.
Why is it important to the school system that these students be found?
Well, obviously, you know, for the first reason is because they want to make sure that they're safe, that they're taken care of, and that they're learning. But there's also an issue of funding. When school districts lose enrollment, that often means they lose state dollars because a lot of state funding formulas are based on the number of students that school districts have. But when I've talked to school districts, their first priority is making sure that they find the student and ensure that the student is safe and getting them back into school, getting them back into the fold.
And what have they found about where some of these students are?
So I spent some time in Detroit, Michigan, with a whole team that was going out and trying to touch base and connect with kids who had either not shown up at all or were showing up very infrequently. What they found in some cases is that the students have broken devices. They don't know how to log in. The parents thought that they were logging in, but they were not. And then in some really, really sad cases, school district employees have come upon homes that don't have power. So the children simply had no way to connect to virtual learning.
Who's responsible, Mariah, for tracking these kids down?
So a lot of places, and the reason I wrote this story, a lot of places have had this issue in the past, but it's been much, much smaller. But because it's such a large issue this year in many places, they've had to develop new techniques, new efforts. So in Detroit, for example, they have rounded up a whole bunch of volunteers and school staff, and they dispatch these people and they give them a list of addresses to go check in at. So they're trying to meet people face to face. In other places like Sacramento and also New Mexico, school district employees didn't necessarily have a really robust way to go find kids before. And so now what they're doing is partnering with social service agencies, for example, to see if they have addresses for the children that they can provide, or a food stamp program is the same thing. And then this also allows them to check in and partner with these agencies to ensure that they're removing the barriers to learning, right? So things like trying to connect them to some place that can help them with the power, trying to connect them with food programs and things along those lines.
We're speaking with Mariah Balingit at the Washington Post. So what happens when they come across students that need help?
Teachers are often sort of the frontline detectors of things like child abuse and neglect because they see the children every day. They know how they normally behave. And we know that child abuse reports have plummeted tremendously. And that's not because child abuse is, the experts don't believe that's because there's less child abuse. They just believe it's not being reported. And kids not going to school is a big reason for that. So it just makes it a lot harder to check in on the safety and welfare of kids from day to day when they're in a virtual setting and not coming to school every day. I think a lot of this issue is because school districts are not really good at communicating with one another. So, for example, in some states, if a child decides to move out of the district and enroll in another district, sometimes that child's home district doesn't find out about it. So that has been the case for hundreds of kids. For example, in New Mexico, where at the start of the year, they were missing something like 12,000 students. Many of those students were simply found in other districts. And in other cases, they were actually being homeschooled, but the parents had failed to file the proper paperwork. So some of this is a lack of communication between districts and not having a good unified way of communicating when districts or when children move across district lines.
Thanks, Mariah. Mariah Bollingit at the Washington Post. Coming up next, will we ever reconnect with our work friends? Dell's semi-annual sale is the perfect opportunity for a significant business upgrade. Save up to 45% on Dell computers built for business and powered by Intel Core processors. Plus, enjoy special pricing on Dell docks, monitors, servers, and more, all with easy financing options through Dell Financial Services. Speak to a Dell Technologies advisor today to find the right tech for your business with fast, free shipping. Call 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. As you know, the pandemic has emptied downtown buildings and along the way done a number on things like office plants, gossip, and relationships, even with people you didn't know that you would miss. It's a story by Beth Tytel, reporter at the Boston Globe. Beth, what inspired this?
You know, I was thinking about it just for so long. Obviously, like everybody else, it's been almost a year, and I got an email from one of my colleagues, and he wrote, it really stabbed me in the heart. He said, "You're starting to feel like an old friend from a city I used to live in." And I thought, wow, like, I thought back to how I used to know what he had for lunch every day. I mean, his takeout order was more familiar to me than what my own teenagers were eating. But, you know, I no longer even know what's up with his beard or his hypochondria. And those are topics we used to cover with Zeal, but they seem so weird to get into on a call. And I think that's what struck me, that you have these relationships where you talk about things, and then it just somehow, in many ways, it can be really hard to translate that into like a call that you're making, because as you pointed out, making people feel that what used to be a casual conversation, now if you have to do some outreach, one woman likened it to dating. She said,
"Wow,
like, I feel like people are going to think, am I weird? Why am I calling them?" I'm actually suggesting that we have a national Call Your Work Friends Day.
I like it.
Call three work friends. So you don't even have to explain why you're doing it.
Wow. So you referenced Malcolm Gladwell in your story and how he said, we associate with the people who occupy the same small physical spaces that we do. And this, I presume, the pandemic and our work arrangements only sets us back.
Definitely. He wrote about that in The Tipping Point, and it's something that social scientists have talked about, which is the role that proximity plays in relationships. It's much larger than you'd think. It's like, you're apparently most likely to be friends with the person who sits next to you at work and the neighbor right next to you. And I guess you can see that. I was thinking about the people, not just who I work with, but people I've sat directly next to. And you do have that kind of intimacy that can arise just from familiarity. Like, that's sort of the person they see you off duty at work. It's almost like your little home at work. I think it's hard, because what are we supposed to do now? But it is, so much is being lost. I mean, so many people have written to me and just, people I would have thought would have kept in touch with others said that they're having a hard time doing it. And then one woman was saying that she's feeling like other people are kind of all business on the phone, but then she realized she is too, because she's not even doing anything to make small talk about.
Oh, wow. We're speaking with Beth Tytel, reporter at the Boston Globe. She's got a good piece entitled, "Where Have All the Work Friends Gone?" There was somebody saying in your story too, kind of even the pizza Zooms are falling off.
Yeah, that's what she said. Like, those were always sort of awkward in the beginning of the pandemic. Remember, every office place was having like, "Hey, we're going to have a pizza lunch," and like the boss would pay for everybody would individually order pizza. And I think after a while, they began to just kind of feel like a chore, or just really didn't do it. And now that even those are gone, people are kind of missing those. And she was saying that's kind of like a sign of how disconnected we are, that we're not even trying to do something that we used to complain about.
But it's not all poo-poo. You said pandemic shutdowns actually have strengthened some coworker relationships. You find an example?
Yeah, some people are telling me that they are, like, during the pandemic, they have more time because they're not commuting. So they will keep up with their pod mates. Like, they have, like, a group text going all day long. Or, like, I didn't meet anybody who had a group Zoom just open like you would as if you were in the office. But some people have said that, and also that they've gotten to know, you know, for years you hear work people talking about their family members, children, pets, and now all of a sudden you can often see those people. So people say it kind of has given them a window into a fuller part of their colleagues' lives. But I think that the experience for most people really is that they're just feeling kind of lonely. Somebody said something interesting. This one named Shasta Nelson, who's an author of The Business of Friendship and a friendship expert, was talking about how work friends see a different side of you than other friends, which I thought was kind of cool. Like, they're the ones who really appreciate all that goes into what you do and can really talk to you about that. And when you're not with them, you miss that.
That was an excellent point. Yeah, I thought the same thing. So what's the national day you've proposed?
I think it's like National Call Three Work Friends Day.
I like
Friday,
that.
March 12th.
Thanks, Beth. Beth Tytel, reporter at the Boston Globe. Jews who adhere to dietary laws are increasingly seeking options beyond the old school favorites that can be adapted to suit the rules. More from this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
Who doesn't want barbecue? Well, if you adhere to strict kosher dietary laws, it can be tough. As Charles Passy of the Wall Street Journal tells us, some delis are adapting to suit kosher rules. Charles, for those who aren't familiar, what about barbecue makes it difficult to eat kosher?
Well, the big thing is that you can't have pork if you're adhering to kosher dietary laws. I mean, pork, shellfish, there are a few things that are not allowed. The meat must also be, the animal must be slaughtered, and the meat must be prepared a specific way. So that also means that the meat, kosher meat, is also typically more expensive. But the big thing when it comes to barbecue is no pulled pork if you're at a kosher barbecue place.
Who did you talk to for your story, and what changes did they make in their delis?
Well, the big person who's kind of been a leader in this of late is a gentleman by the name of Izzy Eidelman. And he has just opened his second New York City kosher barbecue restaurant. He had one in Brooklyn. And he just added one in Manhattan. You know, I would say that ultimately you don't have to do a lot because it just means you're basically eliminating one category. So there's no spare ribs. There's no pulled pork. But there is plenty of brisket. And so he's kind of made, I would say, beef and brisket the stars of his menu. He does do a smoked chicken sandwich, I will say. And he does do things like lamb ribs. And he adds some Mexican food, of all things. So there is some depth to the menu that you might say is a function of not having pork on it. But, you know, he builds his barbecue around brisket, which, by the way, is what they do in Texas. Texas is not about the pork. It's about the beef brisket. So you know, in some ways, you could almost say he's just created a very good Texas-style barbecue restaurant in New York that happens to be kosher. But, you know, so I would say that's kind of key to his success. There are some others who are doing it. Again, they have to adhere to the rules, so there's no pork. There's one barbecue place. He does a mobile operation out of the New York metro area. He does a lot of sausage. So, again, all made with beef, but he has Italian-style sausage. He has Polish-style sausage, Portuguese-style sausage. So, you know, there are other people taking their own spin on it. You know, but again, you know, you really don't necessarily need, you know, barbecue is a world that goes well beyond spare ribs.
We're speaking with Charles Passy of the Wall Street Journal. Charles, are the products popular beyond New York City?
Kosher barbecue is definitely trending in other communities. There are people who do it in Texas. There are people who do it in Georgia. You know, it is, and there's even an Atlanta kosher barbecue festival. So it's spread all over the country. I think we have to be clear that kosher barbecue typically is targeting Jews who are observant, meaning who keep kosher. It's not that those who don't keep kosher and non-Jews can't eat it. It certainly is open to those. But I would say that, you know, anybody who opens a kosher barbecue restaurant is making sure he or she is doing so in a place where there is an Orthodox Jewish community that wants this product. I mean, you know, that you're probably not going to try to appeal to Jews, to non-Jewish customers as your target market. In particular, that's because of the cost. You know, we're talking brisket that goes for $48 a pound. So, you know, a kosher consumer understands that and knows that kosher meat is more expensive and is willing to pay that price. A non-kosher consumer might say, hey, this looks very tasty, but they might opt for, you know, a barbecue that's a little bit more affordable.
There's so many food fads these days, especially in the last year with the pandemic. It seems like everybody's interested in cooking and cooking shows. Are the tastes similar with a kosher barbecue, or some of the delis and chefs trying out new recipes that would make it a little different than what's traditional?
Well, I would say that, the core smoked brisket, for example, that Izzy does, which has won awards. It's been a winner in one of New York's biggest barbecue competitions. So it's always recognized outside the kosher mainstream. I would say that is just classic Texas-style smoked brisket. By the way, it is very, very good. But he does do things with it. I mean, he uses the same spicing. I'm talking about his traditional kosher, his traditional brisket. But he does other things with meat where he uses pastrami spicing. Pastrami is, of course, a beloved staple on delis, and particularly in kosher delis is kind of where it emerged from. He uses that same spicing in some of his other dishes, so he gets creative. I mentioned he has a chicken sandwich. He has a very unique chicken sandwich, which, by the way, that could be done in a non-kosher restaurant. He just happens to have done it in a kosher restaurant. He smokes the chicken and then fries it. So you've got both the crispiness and the smoky flavor all at once. So he's definitely getting creative. And I think people, you know, I think generally chefs these days are in a very creative mode. But I would say a kosher barbecue place is almost forced to be a little bit creative, again, because if they want to expand the menu beyond a certain point because they don't have pork to work with, I think it forces them to be a little bit more, just up on their game.
That's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Charles Passy.
For the ones finding new ways to ensure the job always gets done. For the ones wearing many hats. For the ones who are hands-on, even from far away. And the ones keeping business moving forward. We are Grainger, offering supplies and solutions for every industry, with 24/7 support and experienced staff at over 250 local branches. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour. A reminder to plan for relocation and infrastructure risks. Also, timing Social Security. Plus, how we've become a nation of video streamers and museums launching COVID-19 exhibits. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. This portion of the program is brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. For more, search Michigan Pure Opportunity. A good chunk of Texas has experienced recent extreme infrastructure failure with recent winter storms. Electricity, natural gas, and water all failed across a large section of the state. Given we've known for some time that infrastructure across the nation is reaching critical points of failure, care should be taken to not trade one problem for an even bigger problem if your company is considering relocating. It's true of Texas and anywhere. More from Rob Enderle, tech analyst for the Enderle Group. Rob, your take.
Well, so U.S. infrastructure is in pretty bad shape. We've had administration after administration promise to fix the infrastructure, but the funding hasn't shown up and the infrastructure hasn't gotten fixed. Texas and California are both showcases of what can happen when you let things go too long. But there are other states that have equally bad problems, roadways, bridges, plumbing, electricity, all of that. And a lot of companies, when they get upset with one state because things aren't working out, in this case California, they plan to move to Texas because things look so much better there. And, of course, we just had that catastrophe in Texas showing that, yeah, not really. So what I'm recommending is that before you plan to relocate from where you are, someplace else, make sure you do an infrastructure audit on the location you're going to make sure you're not jumping from the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah. What exactly does that mean when you suggest doing an infrastructure audit? What would be involved?
Well, there's actually a procedure for that. An infrastructure audit is a thing. And so what you do is you go look at the stability of the infrastructure. What are the disaster preparedness plans? What's the failover capability if something happens? If there is a weather event, has the infrastructure been hardened against that event, which is really what caused the problem in Texas, is they hadn't spent the money to harden their power infrastructure to handle weather, and the end result is the cold weather took it out. Could have taken it out for months if they hadn't shut everything down, because the because it would have chewed itself up if they'd let those the generators keep operating. So in the end, Texas was saved from something even worse, but that something worse could still happen in the future. And so what you get from the audit is, okay, here are the kinds of risks you're taking. Now, you may still decide to move there, but you might move there with, you know, water backup plans if the water infrastructure isn't any good, power backup plans if the electrical power isn't any good. I mean, fortunately, you can do wind, solar, and even geothermal is coming back as maybe a better alternative to both of the other two, and just as green. So you can put in place plans so that if you do move, you're not hit by a disaster that could have been forecast.
We're speaking with Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. He's written a piece for itbusinessedge.com called "Texas Outages Are a Reminder to Plan for Relocation and Infrastructure Risks." You referenced too, it's kind of like employee tracking advice, I guess, or to help make sure employees are okay. A BlackBerry ad hoc.
Ad hoc. Yeah. This is one of the few products in market at scale that allows a company to monitor their employees real time, and the point is if the employee's in trouble, they can ask for help and they can get it. It kind of flew a bit out of what happened at 9/11 when the old BlackBerry service stayed up and running and kept the first responders functioning, and other people were on the BlackBerry a two-way pager at that time working. Now that network, of course, is gone, but ad hoc was brought out to kind of replace that, and so it gives you a chance to one, you can immediately locate where your employees are. Number two, you can find out which employees are at risk or under stress, and then you can get resources to them as you see fit. But it allows you as a manager or a site controller to take an assessment not only of your physical site, which you do with other tools, but of the people that would have to work there, because it doesn't matter if you protect the site. If you lose the employees, you're still out of business, not to mention the fact you've got the guilt of losing the employees. So this allows people to, you know, put in place programs that, you know, allow employees to, for instance, employees that are in pretty good shape can offer their homes up as shelters for those that aren't. But it allows you to coordinate all that activity and do so effectively.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the Enderle Group. You've probably heard this before. You should claim Social Security early because you'll enjoy the money more in your 60s and because you'll spend less later in retirement. Personal finance expert Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com thinks it's nonsense that rests on three wrong-headed assumptions. Jonathan, meaning what?
So over the past few years, I've heard this comment again and again. You should claim Social Security early because you'll enjoy the money more in your 60s and you'll spend less later in retirement. And I believe that this rests on three wrong-headed assumptions. And first of all, the first wrong assumption is that your spending needs should determine when you claim Social Security. So even if you think you're going to spend more money in your 60s than later in retirement, that doesn't necessarily mean you should claim Social Security early. If you've done a half-decent job of saving for retirement, you essentially have two different pools of money. You've got money you're going to get from Social Security, and you've got the money that you have in savings. It might be in a 401k plan or an IRA. And the experts who have looked at this issue say that if you're in reasonably good health and you think that you're going to live to an average life expectancy, which for somebody in their 60s is going to be until their mid-80s, from a financial point of view, in terms of generating maximum income through retirement, the smart strategy is to spend your early years drawing on your savings, that money in your IRA or 401k, and delay Social Security until later so you have that larger stream of inflation-adjusted income to carry you through the latter part of your retirement. In terms of total dollars, that seems to be the optimal strategy.
All right.
Spend down savings first, claim Social Security later.
Okay. Is there truth to the statement that you will spend less each year as you age?
So there is and there isn't. So if you look at the statistics from the federal government, people do indeed spend less as they get older. But, and this is a huge but, it seems the reason people spend less isn't because they want to spend less. It's because they are compelled to spend less. In other words, people get into their late 70s and their early 80s, and they're starting to deplete their retirement savings. They didn't delay Social Security. They no longer have any earned income, and so they're simply unable to spend as much as they want. But what the statistics tell us is that early retirement, people actually tend to spend somewhat less than they're pulling in.
Hmm.
And later in retirement, they're actually spending more than they're pulling in. So what that says to me is that people would spend more, but they simply can't because they're running out of money, or perhaps they're scared about spending more because they can see that they could potentially run out of money, or perhaps they're worried about medical expenses down the road. Whatever it is, people later in retirement tend to spend less, but I think they're doing it out of fear.
Okay. And I guess it could come down to some semantics too, right? Or an actual dollars comparison. If you say you wind up spending more in your later years, you're actually spending more of your lesser income, potentially?
Exactly.
Okay.
So what we see is that, you know, people's income goes down later in retirement, presumably because they're no longer earning money, presumably because they're starting to deplete their savings, and yet they're spending all of that money and they're starting to run down their savings balance. So that's an indication to me that people are financially stressed. They're spending as much as they dare to spend, but in all likelihood, they would like to spend more if they could.
Yeah. We're speaking with Jonathan.
And this sort of brings me to, you know, an example which I think is pretty powerful. So I'm age 58, and when I travel, which of course I'm not doing much of these days, but when I travel, I'm happy to fly economy. You know, I take public transport to the airport, or, you know, all of those things. When my mother, who is 81, travels, she's at the point where she likes to travel business class, where she likes to hire a driver to meet her at the airport. And she does that because she can afford to do it. She also does it because that's what it takes for her to travel comfortably.
Yeah.
And she needs to be in business class in order for the trip to be enjoyable for her. That's not true for me at this point. So all those people who think you're going to happily spend your 80s, you know, sitting in an armchair, watching reruns of old TVs or reading a novel, I don't think that's true.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. Coming up next, our obsession with streaming services. Dell's semi-annual sale is the perfect opportunity for a significant business upgrade. Save up to 45% on Dell computers built for business and powered by Intel Core processors. Plus, enjoy special pricing on Dell docks, monitors, servers, and more, all with easy financing options through Dell Financial Services. Speak to a Dell Technologies advisor today to find the right tech for your business with fast, free shipping. Call 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL. Thanks for joining us. We used to complain that there were too many streaming services battling for our money. Now we can't binge enough. Of course, the coronavirus restrictions have changed our entertainment behaviors. As a result, nearly all Americans subscribe to a streaming service, with most of us paying for perhaps five or more. Insight from Mike Snyder, tech reporter at USA Today. Mike, paint this picture.
Since we've been at home for the last 10 to 11 months, and movie theaters were closed for much of the time. I think now they're like 25 or 30% open. And we can't go to concerts, can't go to sports events. So we got our entertainment at home. Well, back in around 2018 or so, people had two or three services on average across the U.S. Now there's all this data coming out from last year that shows that most homes may have five subscriptions or more. So, you know, if we're home a lot, we may see everything we want on either Netflix or Disney Plus or whatever. We need to get another service. So you may have gotten Amazon Prime because you got things delivered over the pandemic. So now you check out HBO. We have new services, HBO Max, you know, that came out that maybe you decide to try that. So people are investing more money in streaming services because they need something in their downtime.
Jeez. The five services is just amazing. Do we keep all those when, say, we return to what we'll consider the new normal in, I don't know, late summer, early fall?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, the easier it is for them to cancel a service and restart it, they're more likely to stay with the service. And they use as the topic example, this is Netflix. I mean, you can just pause your Netflix and get it back. And what they're saying is you may actually need to give them a time to pause and then automatically restart. They need better customer service to keep these services in the months going ahead. But, you know, I think even just thinking of myself, I'm not automatically going to become the guy I was a year and a half ago when I get my COVID vaccine. I mean, I think a lot of people are going to be, you know, very cautious about how they go out in the public. So there's a good chance that these services will keep will keep the subscribers. And if they keep adding, you know, as HBO Max had Wonder Woman, Disney had Soul, and I think Mulan, I forget what Mulan was free. Or I think the live action was free. Anyway, if they keep adding these, you know, what would be possible blockbusters at theaters, they put them on the service and you get it. You've already paid for it. I mean, that's a good way to keep it. We always know there's something coming down the road. We may stick with the service.
We're speaking with Mike Snyder, tech writer at USA Today. He's written about the sharp increase in the way we use streaming services. Are you more likely to have a streaming service, Mike, if you're a cable cutter or you support cable cutting?
Well, I think there's no research on that, but just on all the coverage I've done over the years, I think, number one, if you are a cable cutter, yes, you need the service because that's how you get your content.
Yeah.
Now we also have a lot of more than half of homes that have a traditional pay TV service like cable or satellite or fiber optic or whatever also have streaming services. So as you're seeing these streaming services build up good original content that you're not going to get on a traditional pay TV system, they get these too. I mean, the average home pays at least $100 for TV content. That's not even counting their broadband service and anything else.
Yeah.
So you're seeing the services are doing a good enough job at creating content that people can only get there. That's why we're seeing these subscribership numbers increase.
Thanks, Mike. Mike Snyder, tech reporter at USA Today. By the way, at the end of last week, speaking of streaming services, CBS All Access is now Paramount Plus. And that library has more than 20,000 episodes and movies from the likes of BET, CBS, Comedy Central, MTV, and Nickelodeon. We'll finish with this. In South Florida, the pandemic is already history. On display at History Miami Museum in downtown Miami are a first grader's virtual homework log with Zoom links and a black Grim Reaper suit that a lawyer wore to beaches last year to warn visitors about the deadly virus. The Wall Street Journal says other museum curators in the U.S. and abroad have started gathering similar objects. The Smithsonian's National Museum of American History in Washington, D.C. is asking people to keep hold of pandemic-related things. Anthony Fauci, chief White House medical advisor on COVID-19, donated his personal 3D model of the virus this past week. Museums have found such day-to-day items as the junior hockey league coach's letter informing his team the season was canceled, and a pair of earrings depicting toilet paper rolls, one full, one empty. In Waterloo, Iowa, the Grout Museum District acquired a face shield made with a university's leftover stash of acetate transparencies made for overhead projectors. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. GEICO.com. Easy.